the head officer, Richmond Society, the commission is looking at Charles McNeil, after the ball, the appellant, the non-gay runner, was a part of that decision to be appointed.
Good morning, may it please the court. My name is Charles Allen, and together with Ashley Mullen, I represent the appellant, James Thorson, an attorney, and his practice group, Thorson & Shear, LLP, and James P. Thorson, PC. The facts in this case are not complex. This case arises out of the drafting of a will. In the spring of 2003, Mr. Thorson was retained by his client, Alice Stumville, to draft a will for her. At that time, he was representing her on other matters, including a very protracted divorce proceeding. After he agreed to do her will, Ms. Stumville informed Mr. Thorson that she wanted all of her property to go to her mother, but if her mother predeceased her, for it to go to the Richmond Society for the Prevention of Cruelty to Animals. The will was drafted and executed on April 16, 2003. As drafted, it provided that all of Ms. Stumville's estate would go to her mother. However, contrary to her intentions, it provided only that her tangible personal property would go to the RSPCA in the event her mother predeceased her. Ms. Dumble died on May 16, 2008, more than 5 years after the will had been executed. Mr. Thorson was appointed co-executor of the will, and upon discovering the error, he initiated an action in the Chesterfield County Circuit Court to construe the will consistent with what he knew Ms. Dumble's intentions were. However, the circuit court ruled that the will was unambiguous and the remainder of Ms. Dumville's estate passed intestate. As a result, the RSPCA did not receive $675,000 approximately that it would have otherwise received. Now, there are three reasons why the trial court erred in this matter, and the court should reverse the trial court's ruling and enter judgment in favor of Mr. Thorson and his practices. First, the RSPCA was not, as a matter of law, and as well as after consideration of all the evidence, a third-party beneficiary of the retention agreement between Mr. Thorson and his client, Ms. Dumville. Second, the RSPCA cannot claim third-party beneficiary status because under Virginia Code Section 5522, that section expressly provides that third-party beneficiary status only applies when the contract is in an instrument, that is, a writing.
But the common law had allowed third-party beneficiary status for unsealed documents for generations.
Well, that is what the case of Ward says, Your Honor. But, in fact, there is no decision where an oral contract has come before this court and the court has expressly said that 5522 permits it. And the case of Ward was actually a written document case. So the language in that case, to the extent one can read it to mean that it applies to oral contracts, is dicta.
Well, no, what I'm getting at is not that the statute applies to parole or oral contracts, but that the English common law recognizes third-party beneficiary status, and the statute doesn't reverse that or attempt to supersede it. It just adds clarity on sealed or written instruments.
Well, in the case of Copenhagen, Your Honor, which is very similar to this case, the court expressly said we do not rule upon the question of whether or not an oral contract can be the subject of a 5522 third-party beneficiary status.
Well, forget the statute for a second. Under English common law, which is the law of Virginia unless the court has changed it or the legislature has changed it, can an unsealed contract or an oral contract produce, in theory, a third-party beneficiary standing claimant?
There have been cases in the common law in the English common law where that's been the case. But in the Commonwealth of Virginia, the remedy applied by the General Assembly has been that it only applies to a written instrument.
The common law is not superseded by a statute unless it's very clear the statute intends to supersede it. So if this statute said third-party beneficiary status is limited to written instruments, you'd have a killer argument. But does it say that?
Your Honor, the written instrument, the instrument is in the statute, and the plain and unambiguous words of the statute that provide that it has to be an instrument. But notwithstanding that, The two remaining arguments remain before the court. One is that the statute of limitations has expired, and the other is that they're not a third-party beneficiary as a matter of law because they were a contingent residual beneficiary under the will. Let me take the statute of limitations argument first. This agreement, the retention agreement, was entered in 2003. This case was not brought until 2011. Unless there is some reason why the statute did not run, then I would submit it's clear that under the three-year statute of limitations for an oral agreement, the statute of limitations has applied. It has expired. In 2003, when Ms. Dunville executed her will, she had a document that did not express her intentions. She had damage, and the only way she could remedy that damage was by spending more money either to get a new will or to get a codicil. And the fact that she hadn't paid the money for that is of no moment. That's what the Shipman case says under the payment rule discussion in that case. You don't have to actually pay the damage to have the damage. It's just as if I went to a tailor and said, give me a blue suit, and the tailor gives me a plaid suit. I've not gotten the benefit of my bargain. And I'm damaged at that moment, even though I haven't yet gone out and purchased a blue suit from someone else. She was damaged in 2003 when she executed the document, when it was there and available to dispose of her property. And for that reason, the statute of limitations expired in 2006. And the RSPCA cannot claim that they have a benefit or they have a cause of action remaining after that date. They can't rise any higher than her claim as a third-party beneficiary.
Could the RSPCA brought a cause of action prior to her death?
Assuming they were a third-party beneficiary, which right. We contend they were not. But right. Assuming they were, yes, they could have, because they had to have a benefit. And these benefit and injury are the flip sides of the exact same coin, which is the reason why the RSPCA either loses on the third-party beneficiary status or they lose on the statute of limitations issue. If there was value in having a document that gave them a chance, a lottery's chance, that they might be the recipient, residual recipient of the estate proceeds, then they have an injury because that wasn't what she got. She got something other than that, and they got something other than that. But so if they were a third-party beneficiary and received a benefit, there was an injury at the moment of time the will was executed. On the other hand, if they didn't have a benefit at that time, they're not a third-party beneficiary. Because the whole purpose of the third-party beneficiary rule is that the parties get together and they say clearly and definitely, we're going to make sure that there's a benefit for a third party.
I understand your argument, but how does that work in a will case when the person could always change her will before she died?
Well,
how could the RSPCA sue on a benefit that they haven't received? Hasn't been finalized yet.
Right. But Your Honor, what you're doing is you're making the argument, and I think it's a convincing argument, but one rejected by this court. You're making the argument that no third party can ever be a third, beneficiary of a will can ever be a third party beneficiary of a retention agreement to write a will. And I think that is a good argument to make because of the mutability. That's what Van Dam says. Well, Van Dam says, wills are always changeable. We can always change this. Well, if that's the case, then nobody can ever be a third-party beneficiary, and that's a position that you could intelligently and forcefully argue. That's an argument rejected in Copenhagen.
So what a lawyer should do is just hope the 3 years goes by and he never can be sued for any malpractice.
A lawyer obviously is going to make sure that he does, but the salutary benefits of the statute of limitations always result in some people not getting the benefit of a remedy that they would otherwise have if the statute of limitations hasn't run. Back to my tailor example. If I go to a tailor and I want a blue suit and the tailor delivers to me a plaid suit and a garment bag and I take it home and I let it hang in my closet for 3 years, I lost the opportunity to get a remedy. That's the salutary benefit.
Isn't the irony here that after 3 years, the client, who is actually the party directly in privity, can't sue because the cause of action obviously did accrue. The rescission restitution is gone, benefit of the bargain damage is gone because everything accrues when the damaged product is delivered to the customer, the client, the damage, the defective will. But the thing that makes no sense to me under Van Dam is how a third-party beneficiary can have higher rights to sue and to assert a cause of action than the original party in privity.
Well, Your Honor...
But Van Dam seems to say that. That's the problem I'm having with your argument.
No, I don't think Van Dam does say that. I don't think a third-party beneficiary can rise higher than the ultimate party in privity. That's the... one of the cases...
That's a settled principle. I acknowledge it. I'm just struggling with Van Dam. Are you asking us to just own up to it and say that's it needs to be limited or reversed? Or how do you distinguish it, Van Dam?
Well, I'm not sure that I have to distinguish Van Dam. I think I have to distinguish Rutter. And I think Rutter is distinguished by the fact that it's not a statute of limitations case.
It's a survival case.
Van Dam is the case where, just like this, the document was already executed. It was already damaging to the party at the time when it was created. So the Van Dam is a case that supports our position, I would submit. That's
but Rutter was discussed quite a bit in Van Dam, and Rutter was described as the survival action case. But the logic of Rutter is actually the same as the logic of Van Dam. A cause of action exists for survival purposes when it accrues. So, I just don't understand how those cases are consistent.
Well, I think Van Dam is correct and Rutter is wrong. Van Dam says...
So are we asked to reverse Rutter?
Right, exactly. Or limit it to its facts. It's a survival case, and it's wrongly decided. It's wrongly decided because the court said there wasn't any damage by the receipt of a document.
Could it be limited to the survival statute and not tied to the accrual question for statute of limitations?
It could, Your Honor. It could, Your Honor.
Would that be intellectually honest, in your opinion?
Yes. I would like to reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal, if I may.
3 minutes, 46 seconds.
May it please the Court. Michael Lieberman, accompanied by Ben DeMuro. We represent the appellee RSPCA. If I might start with 5522, which I think is the easiest argument. As Justice Kelsey points out, it's been the law in Virginia for centuries, the common law, that in contracts not under seal, anyone for whose benefit the contract is made may sue upon it. And there's been no change to that. The statute, 5522, did make a change for that. And if you look back over the history of the statute as well, it's very clear that that principle, as far as oral contracts, promises that are in the statute, has allowed third-party beneficiaries. No writing is required under those circumstances. Turning to the statute of limitations, the Rutter case, I think, needs more attention. In Rutter, this court held that the decedent had no cause of action during her lifetime because the will never took effect during the lifetime. And in Van Dam, it's made clear that when you're talking about negligently drafted documents, you have to look at the time when the document becomes legally effective. In McClellan, Shipman, in Van Dam, any of the cases the court could look at, it's when it becomes legally effective that you have damage. In a will case, a will does not become effective under a host of your Supreme Court cases until the testator dies. That's the expectation.
May I interrupt you with a question?
Certainly.
If a client goes to a lawyer and says, I want a will and I want it to say A, B, and C,
yes,
pays $1,000 to the lawyer writes the will, keeps $1,000, the will is given back to the client. A year later, the client looks at the will and says, this is not A, B, and C, he got it wrong, it's X, Y, and Z. The product, if you want to call it that, the service is defective, there's a breach, there was a contract, now there's damage. He could either sue, the client can sue the lawyer for rescission and restitution, disaffirm its remedies, saying, you know, I want to rescind the contract, I want my $1,000 back because I ordered an ABC and you gave me an XYZ. Or he could ask for affirmance, benefit of the bargain damages, and say, I'll hire another lawyer to get it right because I really don't trust you anymore, and pays $2,000 to get it right, and assuming there's no mitigation or damages problem. So the thing that I do not understand about this case and the tension between Van Dam and Rutter is how there a third-party beneficiary could ever rise higher in his or her or its rights than the party in privity, directly in privity, for purposes of accrual.
Well, on the hypothetical that you raised, there were no damages until such time that the party acted. Until the party went and corrected the will or went back to rescind the will, it's the party's not damaged at that point in time.
But accrual is not when you pay the money, it's when you sustain the loss. So going back to my example, if there's a client a year later and you're going, this is not what I ordered, this is not what I asked the guy to give me, you got a damage already because you've received a product that you paid for that wasn't the product you asked for.
Except it's mutable. It's not a legally effective document at that point in time. It could be changed at any time.
I'm with you completely on that, too. The damages to the third-party beneficiary haven't come into being yet, but the damage to the party in privity of contract clearly has come into a being. It's nothing different than a contract for services, and the services are defective, and you have the right to affirm the bargain and get replacement or disaffirm the bargain and get rescission and restitution. But they're both damages, both calculations of damages.
Well, in this case, there was a third party beneficiary, which is the RSPCA, which I can go through the facts of why that's the case, or for just this argument, we could just accept that. The RSPCA was not damaged until the testator died. It had no rights before the testator died. The will had no life or force, according to many cases.
I agree with you for purposes of answering my question. They could not have filed a suit, but the party in privity could have. So how can the third-party beneficiary have a higher right to sue under accrual principles than the party directly in privity? That's the part I don't understand.
Well, I don't know that the court has dealt with this issue before, but if you just take each party individually as to who has a cause of action and when has the duty been breached and when has the injury occurred. As to the RSPCA, that's clearly not until the testator died.
Well, that's a great argument, but I'm not educated enough to know what the state of the law is, and I didn't see the briefing separating out accrual principles for third-party beneficiaries, which might be different from accrual principles or privity principles, and that seems to be the only way to get around the problem.
The little bit of research that we did on that, and you're correct, it's not addressed in the briefs. The party is allowed to raise any defenses that the original contractor, the promisee, had. But if you look at that, statute of limitations isn't one of them. The issues that they're allowed to raise are things like fraud and the inducement, things that would nullify the third party's rights. And here, it was the intention of Ms. Dunville to give all of her property. It's the most simple will that any of us will ever see. My entire estate transfers, and I want these benefits to go to one of two parties, depending on survivorship. It was her intention that benefit be conferred at the time of her death, because that's the only time that a will becomes effective. So, in judging when there is damage, I think you have to look at it, what's the expectation? The expectation is, well, this will take place at the time of death. That's when it becomes effective. That's when the damage occurs. Rudder, Van Dam, every case says that you can't have a cause of action until you have damage. And for the RSPCA, who is, if you accept that they are a third-party beneficiary, they have rights under this agreement, but they have no cause of action. They have no damages until such time that Ms. Dunville dies. So the statute of limitation should begin at the time that she passes away. Whether or not Ms. Dunville had any rights, I know Justice Kelsey said that she was damaged. In Rudder, I think the court implicates in any event she had no cause of action. Ms. Duncan, in the Rudder case, had no cause of action. If she had a cause of action, then you would have to have judged. Did she have a duty? Did she have a breach? Approximately caused damages. To say she had no damage during her lifetime, she had no cause of action during her lifetime, to say there's nothing to survive under the survival statute. So Rutter clearly makes the case that, no, there isn't any damage during the course of a testator's lifetime. And I think that same principle would apply here. But the little I have looked at, Judge Kelsey, the answer to your question about raising defenses that the testator might have, it's really a more limited defenses, such as I said, fraud and things of that nature.
Well, let me hammer that down then. Are you saying that it's not fatal to your cause of action if the statute of limitations had run on the testator's cause of action?
Yes, I don't think it's fatal to our cause of action. We have an independent cause of action than the testator, even though I don't think the testator's cause of action had run.
Have you found any case? I know Rutter appears to say that. Have you found anything else that says that?
I don't think there's any other cases that really have addressed that, Your Honor.
But, you know, this principle is pretty broad. There are third-party beneficiaries in construction contracts and intellectual property license contracts. If what you're saying is true, it's a big deal in the law that third-party beneficiary causes of action have different accrual dates than the parties in privity, directly in privity. And literally, if there are contracts that have a long duration, could be decades before one of the contractual parties is released of the potential liability of third-party beneficiaries. That sounds like a strikingly broad concept to me.
But if one looks at why you have insurance contracts for that purpose, they are intended to go for 10 years. They intend that benefit to occur 10 years out. To the extent I understand Your Honor's point, but it's looking at the intent of the parties to that contract to benefit a third party. When was that benefit supposed to occur? Now, in a will case, to be candid with you, Kelpenhaven was decided in 1989. As far as I know, this is only the second time anyone has brought this type of case in a court. These are very, very hard cases to ever show a third-party beneficiary case. We were able to show it in this case because of the underlying aid and guidance hearing that took place. And our testimony is not dependent at all on the will. We don't look to the will for evidence. We absolutely are not. We are looking to the testimony of Mr. Thorson, sworn testimony from 2008, 2009, his letters in 2003, where he sets forth it was the intention of Ms. Dunville at the time of the initial interview and his intention, at least his instructions that he agreed to do, to create this will for the benefit of Ms. Dunville, which, of course, the will would come into place when she dies. And she wanted to confer everything, to either her mother or the RSPCA, who was taking care of her.
So can I interrupt you a second? I don't think we have a whole lot of question with what you're talking about now, but back to what Justice Kelsey and I keep asking about, does it make sense then to limit this to a will situation, to limit the fact that a third-party beneficiary has a different accrual date of the cause of action than the testator?
I think it would make sense. I had a lot of trouble in going over this with my colleagues, trying to figure out other mutable instruments that this might impact. And I'm sorry, I'm just not that well-versed, I guess, in every aspect of the law, but we really didn't come up with any that would be analogous to this. But in a will situation, it is mutable, and it only becomes effective at the date of a testator dies, and that is the expectation of the parties. They know that at the time it's executed. And in the rarest of cases where there's a third-party beneficiary who has the right to bring the action, yes, it should be that the cause of action arises when there is damage. And that would be consistent with every one of you.
One more interruption. In your briefs, you argue that the trend across the country appears to be to try to enable third-party beneficiaries of wills to bring actions.
We're one of a half dozen states that does.
How do they handle this issue of statute of limitations then?
Excuse me?
How do they handle this issue in a different statute of limitations for a testator than perhaps for...
That's a great question that I guess I need to look at the answer to that.
Okay. That's my second great question this week, so okay.
it was one of the things but the point that was being made, at least in the South Carolina case a couple of years ago, is as we stand right now, there is a subset of attorneys that have immunity, as of right now, based on the Rudder case and depending on how you hold in the third-party situation, that they essentially have immunity for their negligence in writing wills. And I think that would be against public policy, and I don't know that it's good for lawyers to be in a position to have that type of immunity. But that's where we stand. If Rudder is effective, and if you hold this case, the third-party beneficiaries can't bring the action, then it's a terrible situation for lawyers. If you have any other questions, I'd be more than happy to answer them. Otherwise, I think I've completed.
All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Allen. Thank you, Judge.
Thank you, Your Honor.
First, let me address very briefly the aid and guidance litigation and the evidence that came from that. First of all, understand that the testimony and the aid and guidance had nothing to do with the retention agreement. It had everything to do with the testamentary intent of Mrs. Dunbar. Mr. Thorson, when he testified in that, was talking about what he learned in the course of representing her, not what she insisted upon when she retained him.
Well, counsel, doesn't it make sense, though, that a lawyer who wants to retain a client is going to follow the wishes of his client?
Absolutely, but that's not the condition, that is a condition of his duty to the client. There's no question about that. But that doesn't make every beneficiary, then, a third-party beneficiary.
I don't follow that. If his client says, I want you to make this person a third-party beneficiary, isn't that part of the agreement, then, between the attorney and the client?
Yes. If she said, I want to make this person a third-party beneficiary, that would be a part of the agreement. But that's not what the testimony is. The testimony is all about what her testamentary intent was, not about whether or not she wanted to, whether or not, in the course of the retention agreement, she was insisting that he make the RSPCA a beneficiary.
I'm missing the difference here. I'm not following.
Well, it's conflating the representation and of the will of representing someone who wants a will with someone who retains. I don't need to know who you want as beneficiaries to agree to do your will.
But if I tell you I want those as beneficiaries, isn't that part of our bargain?
No.
It's not.
It's not part of it. It doesn't make that person a third-party beneficiary. If you came to me and said, yes, I want you to write my will, and then we start talking and you say, oh, by the way, I want my spouse to get on my property, that doesn't make the spouse a third-party beneficiary. That's in the course of the representation. We have to agree at the retention of me that's part and parcel of my retention.
So I have to stop you and say, okay, I want to make sure you understand this is part of the retention. Wow.
Which is the reason why it would be more beneficial in a case like this to have a written agreement, obviously, for the court.
Isn't that a rather thin distinction that you're drawing with Justice Millett? I was understanding from the arguments that the real debate was whether or not third-party beneficiary status, but incidental versus intended, and whether in a will context, whether contingent residual beneficiaries as a matter of law can ever be intended as opposed to obviously incidental third-party beneficiary.
It is our contention that an incidental contingent beneficiary can never be, it is never, a third-party beneficiary.
So under that logic, if the client goes to the lawyer and says, I want to make 100% to my mom if she's dead, 100% to my dad if he's dead, 100% to the SBCA, whichever ones are contingent and whichever ones are residual, even if it was part of the retention agreement, would not be third-party beneficiaries for purposes of the intended status of third-party beneficiary.
That's correct, and the reason why that makes sense is because at the time when the attorney gets done doing the work that he's supposed to do, under the facts existing at that moment, he was unable to confer a benefit.
Okay, my last question, I promise. That makes a lot of sense, but has any court said that?
No, but remember, we're the handful of courts that really have this issue before us, so the absence of evidence to that effect. But I want to return to the question you had. I don't have time for that, but I wanted to return to the accrual issue. But thank you for your time.
All right, thank you very much. Mr. Rowland, has counsel for the Suslick case arrived? All right, officer, would you call in the hallway for Ms. Amy Davis and see if she has arrived?
She has not arrived, right? So I should not leave.
He didn't have a problem with his insurance company.
All right. The court will be at recess.